Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Bobby Hughes Millman, the co-host of the Writers Lounge. Normally, I'm here with Tom Rydell, but unfortunately, Tom is not doing so well. He's not feeling good and had to take a little bit of time off. And so we're all thinking of Tom tonight and hoping that he's feeling better, sending some good vibes across the airwaves. Hopefully, you're able to listen to us tonight, Tom. But the Writers Lounge right now is planning on taking a bit of a break anyway for the summer. It's a typical break that we like to take in order to give us a little bit of time off and give you a little bit of summer sun and fun. And we should be back by the end of July. So keep your eyes open and keep looking at the site to see when our next interview will be and with which great writer. So tonight we have a really exciting author that we're going to be bringing on in a little bit. His name is Andy Weir, and some of you may know him, but he has written The Martian. Of course, I'm being facetious because Andy has been all over the place, and he's been interviewed by many people, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But his book, The Martian, is right now being finished up as a major motion picture starring Matt Damon. The motion picture is being produced by Ridley Scott. And so we're really looking forward to talking to him and getting some more insights into writing his book and a lot of other fun things we're going to discuss. So first, before we bring Andy on, I wanted to talk a little bit about writing, because that's what we're here for, right? We're the Writer's Lounge. And I wanted to talk about what we are doing in order to promote our books. But I'm going to talk a little bit about that with Andy tonight also. But I've been reading some different articles on different ways that people are using to promote their books or to actually increase their sales. I read a post recently. I've been reading a few different posts about people who have been using the Kindle Select process of being able to offer free ebooks, and hopefully in exchange for getting some great reviews on your book. And some use the 99-cent option. What are you doing to promote your books? If anybody has any additional information that they would like to give on that, then we ask you to call in. We definitely want you to call in and talk to our guest tonight, Andy Weir. Ask him any questions you would like. Tell him how much you enjoyed reading the book or just to say hi. I know Andy will love hearing from you. I talked with several people this week who were very excited about this interview, and many of them said that they were hoping to be able to tune in tonight. So if you are out there, then please give us a call so that we can talk about Andy's book, and so you can ask any questions that you still have while after we're finished asking these questions. So anyway, today We have the review. Now, we're in a different situation tonight because of the fact that Tom originally read the book with the intent that he would be the one interviewing Andy. And typically, I kind of stand in and let Tom do everything. But this time, because I'm going to be interviewing, I also had the opportunity to read his book, and I'm really glad that I did. Because I don't, this is not the type of book that I normally would read. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit later with Andy, but it caught me right from the beginning. And so I, too, have left a review on Amazon for Andy. And so if you would like to go and see what I had to say about the book, please check it out. It will be under Bobby HM on Amazon. So here we go. This is what Tom had to say about the book, The Martian. 6 days ago, hold on for just a second. Okay. 6 days ago, astronaut Mark Watney became one of the first people to walk on Mars. Now he's sure he'll be the first person to die there. After a dust storm nearly kills him and forces his crew to evacuate while thinking him dead, Mark finds himself stranded and completely alone with no way to even signal Earth that he's alive. And even if he could get word out, his supplies would be gone long before a rescue could arrive. Chances are, though, he won't have time to starve to death. The damaged machinery, unforgiving environment, or plain old human error are much more likely to kill him first. But Mark isn't ready to give up yet. Drawing on his ingenuity, his engineering skills, and a relentless, dogged refusal to quit, he steadfastly confronts one seemingly insurmountable obstacle after the next. Will his resourcefulness be enough to overcome the impossible odds against him? The Martian could very well be our future nightmare come true. Astronaut Mark Watney is believed to be dead and left on Mars by his crew. Even more horrifying than that, he is very much alive, but he faces an almost certain slow death from starvation or from several other mishaps. He is stranded, cut off completely from Earth. He is left with only his engineering skills and strong determination to survive. The odds weigh strongly against him. The story of Mark's struggles to survive on the red planet is told to us through a daily journal that he keeps. Being the technically minded astronaut that he is, we don't hear too much about his philosophies or about his life back home on Earth. The journal is largely about the problems he faces and how he improvises and works with the materials at hand to find solutions. Plainly put, it's exactly what one would expect to read from an astronaut if this were reality. The author has undoubtedly done his research and homework to bring us something that will most likely be read by future astronauts who endeavor to travel to Mars. While this story is long and deep in the technical aspects of surviving on Mars, I could not stop reading. I was immediately and completely enthralled by Mark Watney. I liked him. I liked his humor. I liked his do-not-quit attitude. I liked and admired his ingenuity. This is a book that is at present time being read and debated by many. It has rightfully found a home on the New York Times bestsellers list, and it will soon become a major motion picture starring Matt Damon. The first-time author has produced a great story, and he is witnessing a magnificently awesome liftoff in his early career as a writer. I give The Martian 5 stars. So, Andy, are you with us? Andy? Hello? Andy, oh. Are you with us?
Hey, yes, hello.
Hello? Hey, Thanks, there we are. And we're all. Thank you for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm great. I always love, I could listen to people read 5-star reviews of the book all day.
Well, you know, those 5 stars are definitely deserved. As I said, I'm not a space geek. That's not, and oh, I, that may disappoint you, but if
no,
I if I see something, I like sci-fi, but typically if I see something spacey on the cover, I won't pick it up. And so I'm really glad that I am in the position of doing this for Tom, not because I don't want Tom to be here, but because I really wish he was here. But because I get the opportunity to read this book and that I otherwise might not have. And I enjoyed it thoroughly from beginning to end. I ate it up.
Well, thanks.
You're welcome. So this is a book that will appeal not just to people who are space geeks, but even to people who aren't. And I think a lot of the reviews that I was seeing were reviews that any of the ones that were negative were reviews that and there weren't a lot of those, I have to say, so the audience understands that. There's very few, and mostly everybody gave you 5 stars. But when they were giving you the reviews, it was mostly because of all the technical stuff. But like Tom, and Tom asked me, so what did you think about all the technical stuff? And I said, oh, you know, if I really sat and thought about, ooh, how does this work, my mind would probably explode because my mind does not work like yours. However, I knew that it was so important to the story because that's exactly how an astronaut slash botanist slash engineer would think, especially if they were trapped on Mars.
I've been really surprised at how much, I don't know, like I wrote it pretty much for space geeks, for, like me. I wrote it figuring the only people who would ever read it were people who were like, who really were into math and science. I had no idea that like mainstream audiences would take an interest, and I still don't know what I did right. Well, I get the impression from readers that basically the people who aren't that interested in the nuts and bolts just kind of skimmed over the more detailed paragraphs explaining everything. It's just they basically, you reach a point in the novel where you say, like, I'm just going to take the writer's word for it that this is all accurate, and then skip over. I think a lot of people did that. It worked out great because that means everybody's happy. The hardcore geeks who want to see the map, and the people, the story focused people who just want to see the plot developments, worked out. It wasn't intentional, I assure you. I just
well, you know, you the way you wrote the story, and I'll get into some questions in a little bit about that. But the way you wrote the story, first of all, the humor interlaced with all the seriousness that happens, and then the suspense, it really creates that opportunity for people to just be drawn in, whether they're a space geek or not. The space geeks loving every detail that you threw in there. I loved the detail because it made it more real for me. Although I'm not someone who is really that detail-oriented. Where math and physics and trajectories and all that kind of stuff is concerned, I should say. So would you read an excerpt from your book for us, Andy?
Sure. We're on the radio, so I'm going to use substitute profanities.
That's great. Thank you. Saving me.
So this is right from the beginning. This is right in the very first chapter of the book, so there's not really any spoilers in this. And Mark has awakened on Mars after a dust storm forced his crew to evacuate, and he realizes that he's he's just waking up right now, and he's describing the process of waking up. He's unconscious in his spacesuit, and he was hit by an antenna during the windstorm that punctured his suit, and that was the last thing he remembered before being knocked out. So, I awoke to the oxygen alarm in my suit, a steady, obnoxious beeping that eventually roused me from a deep and profound desire to just die. The storm had abated. I was face down, almost totally buried in the sand, As I groggily came to, I wondered why I wasn't more dead. The antenna had enough force to punch through the suit and my side, but it had been stopped by my pelvis. So there was only one hole in the suit, and a hole in me, of course. I had been knocked back quite a ways and rolled down a steep hill. Somehow I landed face down, which forced the antenna to a strongly oblique angle that put a lot of torque in the hole in the suit. It made a weak seal. Then, the copious blood from my wound trickled down toward the hole. As the blood reached the site of the breach, the water in it quickly evaporated from the airflow and low pressure, leaving a gunky residue behind. More blood came in behind, and it was also reduced to gunk. Eventually, it sealed the gaps around the hole and reduced the leak to something the suit could counteract. The suit did its job admirably. Sensing the drop in pressure, it constantly flooded itself with air from my nitrogen tank to equalize. Once the leak became manageable, it only had to trickle new air in slowly to relieve the air lost. After a while, the CO2, carbon dioxide, absorbers in the suit were expended. That's really the limiting factor to life support, not the amount of oxygen you bring with you, but the amount of CO2 you can remove. In the HAB, I have the oxygenator, a large piece of equipment that breaks apart CO2 and gives the oxygen back. But the spacesuits have to be portable, so they use a simple chemical absorption process with expendable filters. I'd been asleep long enough that my filters were useless. The suit saw this problem and moved into an emergency mode the engineers call bloodletting. Having no way to separate out the CO2, the suit deliberately vented air to the Martian atmosphere, then backfilled with nitrogen. Between the breach and the bloodletting, it quickly ran out of nitrogen. All it had left was my oxygen tank. So it did the only thing it could to keep me alive. It started backfilling with pure oxygen. I now risked dying from oxygen toxicity, as the excessively high amount of oxygen threatened to burn up my nervous system, lungs, and eyes. An ironic death for someone with a leaky spacesuit, too much oxygen. Every step of the way would have had beeping alarms, alerts, and warnings, but it was a high oxygen warning that awoke me. The sheer volume of training for a space mission is astounding. I'd spent a week back on Earth practicing emergency spacesuit drills. I knew what to do. Carefully reaching to the side of my helmet, I got the breach kit. It's nothing more than a funnel with a valve at the small end and an unbelievably sticky resin on the wide end. The idea is you have the valve open and stick the wide end over a hole. The air can escape through the valve, so it doesn't interfere with the resin, making a good seal. Then you close the valve, and you've sealed the breach. The tricky part was getting the antenna out of the way. I pulled it out as fast as I could, wincing as the sudden pressure drop dizzied me and made the wound in my side scream in agony. I got the breach kit over the hole and sealed it. It held. Backfilled the missing air with yet more oxygen. Checking my arm readouts, I saw the suit was now at 85% oxygen. For reference, Earth's atmosphere is about 21%. I'd be okay so long as I didn't spend too much time like that. I stumbled back up the hill toward the HAB. As I crested the rise, I saw something that made me very happy and something that made me very sad. The HAB was intact. Yay! And the NAV was gone. Boo! Right that moment, I knew I was screwed. But I didn't want to just die out on the surface. I limped back to the HAB and fumbled my way into an airlock. As soon as it equalized, I threw off my helmet. Once inside the HAB, I doffed the suit and got my first good look at the injury. It would need stitches. Fortunately, all of us had been trained in basic medical procedures, and the HAB had excellent medical supplies. A quick shot of local anesthetic, irrigate the wound, 9 stitches, and I was done. I'd be taking antibiotics for a couple of weeks, but other than that, I'd be fine. I knew it was hopeless, but I tried firing up the communications array. No signal, of course. The primary satellite dish had broken off, remember? And it took the reception antenna with it. The HAB had secondary and tertiary communication systems, but they were just for talking to the MAV, which would use its much more powerful systems to relay to Hermes. Thing is, that only works if the MAV is still around. I had no way to talk to Hermes. In time, I could locate the dish out on the surface, but it would take weeks for me to rig up any repairs, and then it would be too late. In an abort, Hermes would leave orbit within 24 hours. The orbital dynamics made the trip safer and shorter the earlier you left, so why wait? Checking out my suit, I saw the antenna had plowed through my biomonitor computer. When on an EVA, all the crew's suits are networked so we can see each other's status. The rest of the crew would have seen the pressure in my suit drop to nearly zero, followed immediately by my biosigns going flat. Add to that, watching me tumble down the hill with a spear through me in the middle of a sandstorm, yeah, they thought I was dead. How could they not? They may have even had a brief discussion about recovering my body, but regulations are clear. In the event a crewman dies on Mars, he stays on Mars. Leaving his body behind reduces weight for the MAV on the trip back. That means more disposable fuel and a larger margin of error for the return thrust. No point in giving that up for sentimentality. So that's the situation. I'm stranded on Mars. I have no way to communicate with Hermes or Earth. Everyone thinks I'm dead. I'm in a HAB designed to last 31 days. If the oxygenator breaks down, I'll suffocate. If the water reclaimer breaks down, I'll die of thirst. If the HAB breaches, I'll just kind of explode. If none of those things happen, I'll eventually run out of food and starve to death. So yeah, I'm screwed. There you go.
That's great. Yes. So, like I said, you know, you drew me in from the very beginning, from the very first line. But the way you were describing that, the whole in the suit, the space suit, I hadn't thought about the idea that if you bleed in space, of course, all of the fluid would be sucked out, and then it would become sticky like a resin in there, and would plug up the
right,
hole.
Right, it would get funky.
Who is this so brilliant? I encourage anybody who's listening to pick up a copy of this. If you haven't read it yet, pick up a copy and read it, because there's so much more, and it goes into all of the details he goes through to try and save his life. And of course, there are different things that go wrong, and what can go wrong a lot of times does. So that's what makes it so suspenseful and so fun, but especially the way that you wrote it. So what sparked the idea for this novel, Andy?
Well, so like I've mentioned, I'm a space dork, and I've just all my life I've been a big fan of the space program, manned and unmanned spaceflight. And I was just sitting at home thinking, how could we do a manned mission to Mars with our current technology? I wasn't even thinking about a story. I was just thinking about how would we do it. You know, I'm just daydreaming and putting together a mission plan kind of thing. And I was like, okay, well, how do we get there? How do we make sure that the astronauts can get back? And then I started thinking of, like, disaster scenarios. I'm like, okay, well, what if this breaks? How do they make sure not to die? What if that breaks? What if these two things break at the same time? You know, what is the mission plan for these kind of failure scenarios? And I started to realize that, like, the increasingly desperate things that the astronauts would have to do to make sure they stay alive in some of these scenarios were pretty interesting. And I'm like, huh, this could make an interesting story. So I made an unfortunate protagonist and subjected him to all of it.
Yeah, you are pretty cruel to him. But it seems like as a writer, when we write these characters, the ones we love the most are the ones we are so hard on, don't you think?
Well, you know, you got to give them a challenge.
Right, right. So now I read that you have written two other books, and can you tell me about those two books?
Well, sure. The first book I wrote was called The Observer. And I wrote that when I was in college, and it is awful. I mean, it's just truly awful work. It's you know, the first pancake is never that great, right? and so fortunately, I wrote that before the days of the internet. I mean, before the internet had really taken off. So I never posted any version of that online. So it has safely been murdered quietly. Although I think there's still a couple of copies surviving, but, you know, I'm looking for them, to burn them. It's just badly written, and, you know.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. The next book I wrote, that was in the late 90s, or mid to late 90s, like 96 or so. I was working for AOL. Oh, you know what? It was more like 99. Anyway, I was working for AOL, and I got laid off. And I had a really good severance package, and I had stock options. And so I was forced to sell my stock options when AOL happened to be at pretty much its all-time high. I assure you, I would not have made a wise financial decision if it had been up to me, but I ended up forced to do this. So I ended up with, enough money to go a few years without working. And so I thought, I'm going to take my shot at being a writer, because I've always wanted to be a writer. So I wrote a book. It was called Theft of Pride, It was okay. I think the plot is decent, and I think the characters are interesting, but the mechanics, I don't know, the wordsmithing was really poor. It was, you know, clumsily written, hard to read, you know what I mean? And so it just wasn't that good a book. Anyway, over the course of 3 years, I wrote it and then tried to get it published, and I had the usual story that everybody gets. You know, I couldn't get any literary agents to represent me, couldn't get any publishers interested. And I went, well, at least I don't have to wonder what might have been. I gave it a shot, and then I went back into the software industry. So that was my second book. And then The Martian was my third. And I guess the backstory on how that came to be is kind of interesting. At this point now, it's about 2009, and actually earlier, around 2000, 2001, I took an interest in kind of writing short stories online just as a hobby. And so I had a website, and I posted web comics and short stories there, and I was also posting some serials. And The Martian, which I started in 2009, was just one of the serials that I was posting. And I'd post a chapter every 2 months or so, and I'd get reader feedback, and that was cool. That helped spur me on to keep posting it. And then I finished it, and I thought, okay, well, I'm done. I'm done, on to other serials. Then I got emails from people saying, oh, hey, I like The Martian, but I don't like reading it on a website. Can you make an e-reader version of it? So I figured out how to do that, and I posted it online. And then other people emailed and said, oh, hey, I love that there's an e-reader version, but I'm not very technically savvy, and I don't know how to download a file from the Internet and put it on my e-reader. Can you just put it up on Amazon so that I can just get it through the normal Kindle, you know, API or UIs? And so I figured out how to do that. But Amazon makes you charge at least 99 cents. Up until now, I've been just giving it away. And so I'm like, okay, well, I can't charge less than 99 cents, so I'll charge exactly 99 cents. So I told everybody, all right, you can read it on my website, or you can download the e-reader version for free, or you can pay Amazon $1 to put it on your Kindle for you, basically. And more people paid the buck than downloaded it for free, because I guess, Amazon really has quite a reach into the readership market, and people are willing to pay a buck to avoid technical hassles. That got it up into the top sellers lists of Amazon, and it was like number one in science fiction, and it was in the top 10 of several other lists. Then it starts to really snowball, of course, because, you know, you're like, oh, I want to read a book. Oh, I don't know what I want. What are the top sellers in science fiction? Okay, this looks interesting. I'll take it, you know. And that's what got the attention of Crown Publishing, which is an imprint of Random House. And Damon. Next thing I knew, I had an agent and a print deal. And then Fox came for the movie rights, which was like the movie rights deal and the print deal were 4 days apart.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
So that was an interesting story. And then it just kept getting more and more often, as you know, and then we end up with this, you know, Matt Damon and Ridley Scott and this all-star cast and this big budget movie. And I'm just like, wow.
We should all be so lucky to have it go so smoothly as that did. Of course, so as you demonstrated, you didn't have a start in the writing field that was so smooth. You've been able to, it isn't like you just wrote the first thing you've ever written and all of a sudden it's this major motion picture. You still did your time.
Yeah, no, I put in my time, and I wrote three books, a whole bunch of short stories and serials and fan fictions. And I wrote some Sherlock Holmes fan fiction and some Doctor Who fan fiction. I made a bunch of webcomics. Around the time I started The Martian, I had accumulated based on the size of my mailing list, I'd accumulated about 3,000 regular readers, which is a modest, audience. But it took 10 years to build up that reader base, you know. And I don't know if there are any shortcuts. One thing that helped a lot with the reader base was I wrote a short story back in 2009 called The Egg, and it was really popular. And that brought a lot of people to the site. So that was cool.
You know what? It seems like I thought I saw that on Amazon. So did you put it out on Amazon, The Egg?
Not on Amazon. There's an Audible version of it. There's like an audiobook version of it. The whole thing is an 8-minute long audio, quote-unquote, book. Yeah, it's just it's a 1,000-word story.
Oh, yeah. Nice short story, right?
I think one of the reasons the egg was popular was because it's like a good digestible size for an internet reader. It takes about 5 minutes to read. It's the sort of thing you can paste the entire contents of into your blog, and I think that was part of the reason it got around so much.
Yeah. Well, and I thought I read that you started writing short stories when you were 15. Did I read that right? Yes.
Even earlier, I think. I mean, I think the first time, I think 15 is a good answer. That was the first time I wrote, like, an actually coherent short story, you know what I mean? I mean,
right.
As opposed to just, you know, playing around and writing stuff on a typewriter when I was 8, but
right.
Yeah, I think 15 is a good answer.
Ah, good. Now, I remember being in fifth grade and having a teacher who said, everyone in the classroom knew I would be a writer someday. I wasn't sure that I totally believed it, but I did like to write. But then in junior high, I had an English teacher who squashed my dreams. And and I didn't write for years. So if you have an opening and you have that opportunity, and I bring that up not to get sympathy, but to say to anyone out there, if you have something that you want to do, it doesn't matter what anybody else says. If they don't like what you're doing, that's them. And if they don't like what you write, that's not something that says anything about you, because it doesn't matter how much of a bestseller that there is, there are going to be people who don't like it, and there are going to be people who don't like what you write, but there may be a whole lot of people who do. So if you're true to yourself and do exactly what you did, write about the thing that you love. If you have that niche, that thing that you just love in your life, and you write about it, then it will make a difference. You will be able to, you'll be able to write something that someone is going to like.
For sure. I've got a bunch of, you know, 1-star reviews for The Martian. I mean,
I looked at a couple of them, and I didn't, you know, you have so many more that are 4 and 5 star.
It's been very well rated. But all I'm saying is, like, no, you know, people should not be discouraged by bad reviews, right?
Right.
It's like,
oh, yeah.
Everybody
exactly.
gets them.
I mean, look at 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, look at 50 Shades of Grey. Huge commercial success. I think you can find a couple of negative reviews about it out there. I think my favorite negative review of The Martian is, it's one of the Amazon ones. And they said, if you liked the manual to your humidifier, you'll love The Martian. Pretty harsh.
Well, you know, I guess maybe I'm a manual type of person, because I didn't just like it. I loved it, as you know. And I was also crawling around on your Facebook page and looking at the stuff that you had on there. And it's really cool, and it's very fun to look at the stuff that you have posted. One of the things I thought was really great, because I'm a big fan of Mythbusters, you were interviewed by Adam Savage, which
That's right.
was a great interview.
It was really awesome, because I went to his home in San Francisco, and so that, that interview, that room, that the talking room is actually, like, in his house.
His man cave?
That's not his cave. That's actually just sort of a library nook in his house, like next to his living room. But he did take me to his workshop, which is actually in a different building a couple of blocks away. And it's this big, huge workshop. I mean, I think the workshop might be bigger than his house. And it's awesome. I mean, it's just got all these movie props and these projects he's got going on. And I was just like, that he showed me around. We spent like, I don't know, a couple hours in there. He's just showing me stuff, and that was awesome. You only see a few seconds of it, like right at the beginning when he's showing me the 2001 helmet. But that was cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I like that part at the beginning. That was pretty fun when he was showing you the helmet and you were putting that on. That was, but I enjoyed the whole interview. Very interesting. For those who haven't seen the interview, go to Andy's Facebook page and you'll be able to see it and enjoy it. And Adam Savage is his typical self, very lively.
Yep.
And yourself as well. I mean, it was a very enjoyable interview to watch. So I'm going to ask a question that is probably the one you're getting all the time, and I know you had a similar type of question from Adam, but the people who are listening, not everybody may have heard the story, so I'm going to ask it anyway. So excuse me for being redundant.
Sure.
You include a lot of technical information about botany, engineering, chemistry, physics, rocket science, and even computer programming in your story. What kind of preparation did it require for you to make all of this sound so realistic? What kind of research did you have to go to?
Just lots and lots of research and math. And I didn't know anyone in aerospace at the time that I wrote it. I mean, I do now, but I didn't at the time. And so it was just Googling around. Although, to be fair, I started off with kind of a more than average amount of knowledge about the space industry, just because it's been just my hobby for my whole life, right? So I've seen lots of documentaries. I've seen lots, you know, it's information that I've spent a lifetime actively seeking out. But I wouldn't call myself an expert, just an enthusiast, right? And then, but from there, just lots and lots of research and lots of math. It took me 3 years to write the book, and I would say I spent about half my time researching.
It took you how long to write the book?
3 years. But I was mm-hmm. also like working a full-time job, and you know, so that was
right. Yeah.
3 years of nights
and
weekends.
That was a question I was going to ask, because 3 years is actually it's not a terrible amount of time. There are people who take even longer than that sometimes to write a book. So
right. Well, I'm working on my notebook now, and I've got a deadline that was, like, much less than 3 years.
Somebody's waiting for it, obviously. So what is your next project?
Well, I've got a contract.
Right. What is your next project?
It's another science fiction book. It's tentatively titled Zhek, Z-H-E-K. And it's a more soft science fiction story, so it's not the rigidly technical accuracy of The Martian. It's got aliens and faster than light travel and stuff like that.
Uh-huh. Okay, cool. So we'll have to watch for that. Zhek?
Z-H-E-K? Z-H-E-K, yeah, Zebra, mm-hmm. Hotel, Echo... Okay, I don't know what
Kilo.
Phonetic alphabet.
Kilo,
thank you. Yeah, Kilo, there we go. And
my military background.
That'll probably be out. Yeah, nice. I did. Yeah, cool. That'll probably be out in mid-2016.
Oh, good. We'll be looking for that, definitely. Because of all the minute details, I can't help but wonder, you plotted it out so meticulously. Did you ever have times when the minutiae of the story became too much and you had to just walk away? Did you ever just put it down?
Well, it's never too much for me because I like that stuff. I mean, I can just go down the rabbit hole and analyze deeper and deeper, and I'm just happy to do that. But I did run into problems where I'm like, okay, the reader is not going to want to have all this info dumped on them, right? Mm-hmm. I need to make sure. So that was like my biggest balancing act, was saying, okay, what do I actually have to tell the reader? And then, you know, so there's some stuff that the reader has to know to really understand the events of the story. And then there's some mm-hmm. stuff that I want the reader to know because it's cool and it might make the reader go, ooh, neat. And that's a good reaction. Mm-hmm. And then there's other stuff that's interesting to me but isn't interesting to most people. And so I needed to, any given piece of information, I needed to kind of put it through that filter. It's kind of like there's this real urge. There are times when I'd spend 2 or 3 days just doing research and math to figure out something that ended up being like 1 or 2 sentences in the book. And sometimes I was like, oh, come on, it took me a long time to write this. It should take you a long time to read it. But, you know, you have to resist that urge and just keep it interesting, keep things moving.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And I understand what you mean. There are so many times when I feel like I'm doing an information dump, too, and you just have to start cutting things out. And the best thing to do is just put it in, and then you can decide later what you're going to take out once you get to that point.
Yep, that's true.
So that,
one thing is it worked out really well to have the kind of smart alecky main character or first-person narration. So that really let me give a bunch of, like, deep, detailed technical stuff to the reader and break it up with jokes and sarcasm and stuff to make it more interesting.
Right, and it does work. It does work. And that was one of the things I noticed, because you do – when you start getting into all this really serious stuff, I mean, it could be something that's really suspenseful, or it could be a situation where he's explaining some of this, some of the minutia, and then all of a sudden you break it up with something funny, which I thought was brilliant and kept me attached to it. Because like I said in my review, you know, I have ADD, and if you don't keep my mind engaged, I'm off looking for squirrel. I don't have, my attention span isn't good enough. So if you can keep me engaged in this book, then you've done an excellent job. I'm not an easy person to capture in a book.
Thanks.
No, you're welcome. Thank you. And so what was the most challenging aspect of writing The Martian?
Challenging. Well, part of it was just like, it's kind of the same problem every writer has, it's just motivation, just to keep plugging along. And other times it would be like, I would have this cool idea for a plot event that could happen, but then I would do research and find out, no, it wouldn't work out the way I was imagining. It would be very different, or the solution would be trivial, or, you know, whatever. And so oftentimes I had to give up, and that was a little frustrating. I'd be like, oh, man, I had this whole cool plot sequence in mind, and I had to give up on it because, you know, it's just not realistic.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sometimes hard for me.
Yeah, it's hard when you have to, do that. So talking about the voice throughout and the way that you wrote it, when I was reading it, and I imagine it's because I know Matt Damon is doing the movie, but I could hear his voice throughout the book. So were you thinking about any celebrity when you were considering doing, when you were writing this? And did you have anybody in particular in mind when you wrote the dialogue?
No, believe it or not, I didn't really have a firm idea of what Watney looked like. It's kind of how I usually am when I'm writing. I just kind of see the characters as blobs. I don't know how to describe it. I don't get a firm idea. Like, I couldn't tell you, like, what his hair color was or, you know, anything like that. And his personality is pretty much just based on my own. So I'm a smart aleck. And although he's better than me at everything, you know. So he's like this – He has all of the personality traits that I like about myself, and none of the traits that I don't like. You know, he's kind of like what I wish I were.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
I think that's pretty common for authors and their main characters.
Yeah, we tend to do that. We try and put the things we like the best about ourselves into them, and not any of the stuff we don't like. Yeah, so great. And how much control did you have over the script for the movie?
Well, my main job on the film was to cash the check. So I did that.
That's a terrible job.
I know. It's like, no, they so when they get the film rights, they don't need to involve me at all. Like that, beyond once I sign the contract, film rights are theirs. They can go do whatever they want, and I have no power or authority or anything. Other writers sometimes work stuff into their contracts, but you have to be like Stephen King or J.K. Rowling to be able to, you know, have that kind of clout.
Right.
However, they chose to involve me. So, I mean, they didn't have to. They just chose to, and that was pretty cool. And so I was involved in the screenplay. And the screenplay was written by Drew Goddard, very talented writer and director. He directed Cabin in the Woods. He wrote Cloverfield. He wrote a bunch of episodes of Buffy and Lost. He's also the creator and wrote several episodes of the recent Daredevil Netflix series, which was really good. Anyway, he wrote the screenplay, and he went back and forth with me a lot. Like, we spoke on the phone a lot. We emailed back and forth. And then once he had a screenplay, he sent it to me to get feedback. I gave feedback, you know, some things he said, like, oh, yeah, it's a good point, and he made changes. Other things he's like, no, I disagree, and left it as it is. Well, no, but that is the point. It's like, he didn't have to do any of that. Like, he didn't have to talk to me at all. So it was pretty cool to be involved.
Yeah, that is cool. So how close is it to the book? Did they make many changes?
Right. So I can't talk about the screenplay too much, but I can say that I'm very happy with it.
Okay.
I think it came out really well, and I think it'll make a great film.
Yeah, I imagine. It sounds great. I've looked at the trailers, and the trailers, you know, I look at the trailers like, ooh, I remember that part in the book. I remember that part in the book. So it seems like they stay pretty true, pretty close.
It's a good adaptation.
Go ahead.
It's a good adaptation. That's all I'm saying.
Good to hear. Very good. So, I hear you're a Doctor Who fan.
Oh, yes. Huge Doctor Who fan.
Yes. Who's your favorite Doctor?
The Fifth Doctor, Peter Davison.
Really? Wow,
yeah,
that would be the first
time
I've heard that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think you tend to imprint on the Doctor that you started with. And he was the Doctor when I started.
I'm kind of torn between 10 and 11. I did start
and it's
with
definitely my second favorite.
Yeah, David Tennant was And but it's always so hard when, you know, they have to regenerate. But I think we're getting beyond some of our audience, so probably ought to move on. Now, originally I was told that the Martian was scheduled for a November release.
Yes, it's pretty exciting, and this was all just last week that all this came about. So for a long time, the Martian scheduled release date was November 25th, which is the day before Thanksgiving this year. And that's just what they said, and then that was how it was going to be. They were already planning out the premiere and stuff like that and where it was going to be and stuff. And then, rather surprisingly, just last week, they announced that they're moving it up to October 2nd. And there's several reasons for that. First off, there's a lot of competition in that late November time frame. If they open on November 25th, Hunger Games: Mockingjay 2 will have only been in theaters for like 1 week. It will have opened 1 week earlier. So that's a pretty big draw, right? Also, the new Bond film will have been out for a week or two, something like that. And then on the 25th is Disney's new CGI movie, computer graphics movie called The Good Dinosaur. And so there's some pretty beefy heavy hitters coming out right around that time. And they realized that October looked pretty much wide open. And so the response to the trailer was so good, they decided that they think they can own the box office for a while. They think that it would have legs. And so by moving it back to early October, they think that, okay, well, then maybe it'll go well. Maybe it'll just keep selling, and there's not a huge amount of competition in October. Interestingly, yeah. Once they moved The Martian to October 2nd, the studio, so there was originally planned for October 2nd was London Has Fallen, which is an action movie, the sequel to Olympus Has Fallen. And they moved, the studio that owns that, moved it off of October 2nd to get it away from The Martians. So that's
really?
A good sign.
Oh, you're dangerous.
Yes.
Well, I was really excited to hear that. I don't have to wait until November. And, yes, I'm anxiously awaiting Mockingjay, the final. And of course, James Bond as well. So October 2nd sounds good to me, a little sooner. I don't have to wait so long. And
yeah, it's also when Gravity released. That was the same weekend Gravity released. And Gravity... Yeah. Well, they would like it to have a similar thing as Gravity is, because Gravity was the same thing. It came out in early October, and it just kind of like did really well, didn't have too much heavy competition, and people really liked it. So, yeah.
So, happens when The Martian gets nominated for some Academy Awards? What will you do?
What would I do? I guess I would watch the Academy Awards very eagerly that year.
You're hopefully going to be watching from the audience.
I don't know. Do they bring the you know the novelists there?
The author? Well, I would hope so.
But I didn't write the screenplay, right? So if it were
bug in there.
I mean, if it were nominated for screenplay, then it would be Drew Goddard who would be the nominee, right?
Yeah, but you should be there. You should be there. You should just be there. That's my personal
opinion. Science fiction generally doesn't get too many Oscar nods, but if it's nominated for any Oscars, I'll ask the studio if there's any way I can get in.
Okay. All right. And you're inviting me to the premiere of The Martian. I've heard. I'm kidding.
Am I? Actually, I'm a good little boy. I'm taking my mom.
You're taking your mom? Oh,
yep.
That is so cool. Good for you. Good
job.
Yeah,
I got to do all sorts of cool stuff over the past year because of the popularity of Martian. And among other things, I got to go to, I got to take a tour of NASA's Johnson Space Center. Like, they gave me this VIP treatment and everything like that. And I took my dad to a bunch of that stuff. So fair is fair. I need to take mom to some things.
Mom's
so
friend.
She gets to go to the premiere. Yeah.
She would love it. She will have a great time.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure she will.
Yeah. I've been to one premiere. It was one of the Star Trek movies. I can't even remember which one. One of the earlier, Patrick Stewart ones. And, and it was a lot of fun. It really was a lot of fun. So you will have a great time, and I look forward to hearing more from you. And do you have any passing thoughts that you'd like to add?
Well, your audience are mostly writers, right?
A lot of them are writers, yes. Although
yeah.
I've been
so
passing
would...
it on to everyone who follows me. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I would offer this advice on writing, for what it's worth. First off, in order to be a writer, you have to actually write. Sitting around daydreaming about what your story is going to be like is not actually writing. And, you know, that's the hard part, sitting down and actually typing out the words onto a piece of paper. You have to actually do that. So don't delude yourself into thinking that you're actually writing a story by just sitting around thinking about what the plot's going to be. That's number one. Number two is resist the urge to tell your friends and family about your story ideas. And that's really hard because when they're interested, it's even worse because they're interested and they actually say, oh, this is cool. Tell me more. And they're not just placating you. They're actually interested. You still have to not tell them because it satisfies your need for an audience and makes you less motivated to actually write it. So set yourself a rule that says the only way anyone gets to find out about this story is by reading it. So the only way I'm ever going to get that audience is by actually going through the effort to write it. And then the final bit of advice is there has never been a better time in history to self-publish. The internet has basically removed the old boy network that exists between you and your readers. You can just go straight to them now, with no personal financial risk at all. It's great. So if you've got a story in you, write it down. No one can stop you from publishing it. So that's my advice to writers.
That is such great advice. Thank you for adding that in. Now, if any of our listeners want to reach you, how can they do that?
Well, the best way is just to email me. I have a very public email address. You can find it on my website. I can say it, but it's cephalon@comcast.net. And so that's, you know, Sierra Echo Polka Hotel Alpha, what's L?
So basically they should Google your name.
Yes.
And they will
find you. They can Google my name. They Google my writing site, just Andy Weir Writing, and there's this really low-quality website where I just have raw links and stuff, and it includes my email address.
Very good.
And I answer all email.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Andy. It has been such a pleasure talking with you. I know that when I first posted this on my Facebook page, I had people who were commenting saying, oh, I love that book, or all my husband and my boys have read that and they love it. And so I'm getting so much feedback just from the people who are in my network. And so you have such a great gift, great talent. Oh, it looks like someone is trying to call in, but we don't have any time. We only have, I'm sorry, caller. We have less than 4 minutes left. So I apologize. So Andy, thank you for your time. And I hope that you can, that we'll be able to cross paths again when you have your second book out. And I look forward to being able to talk about that book with you. And I look forward to reading it, as a matter of fact.
All right.
So,
thanks for having me. And caller, an unfortunate caller, just email me whatever question you had.
Okay, I will have them do that. Thank you so much. And
all right,
you have a great day. Thanks, Andy.
You too. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you for joining us today for the Writer's Lounge. It has been such a pleasure to talk with Andy Weir and to discuss all of the ins and outs of how he created this big blockbuster from this book. Just very intriguing to hear his insights. And, he gave a lot of information that was even that I found very helpful and that I hadn't heard before from other writers on the show or in other places. So if you want to give him a call, send him an email or contact him on his website, then you can do so. Just do a Google search of Andy Weir. And again, the Writer's Lounge will be taking a break until the end of July. And hopefully Tom will be feeling better and will be able to be back with us. And so stay tuned, everyone, and we'll look forward to seeing you again. And have a great writing experience, and may all of your dreams come true. Bye-bye.